All right, good morning. If you would, turn to 1 Kings chapter 18. I am tempted to apologize because probably most of you have sat under a service in the last 2 or 3 years where we have looked at this passage, but I'm not apologizing for that because I know we can read different accounts of the Bible numerous times and learn something new each time, and so God has prepared us to hear this portion of His Word today for just such a time as this, and so let's open our hearts to His Word and see where we can apply it to our lives. So we're going to be looking at actually chapter 18, verses 1 through 40. I think Ryan might have asked me to do this only because he knows this is one of my most favorite passages. Chris mentioned when we were praying out back in the office that he knows this is a passage that has meant a lot to me. In some ways, I can't even share some of the things that God has been doing through this passage, but after the book of Ruth, this is right up there in the tops for me. I almost said the word story. I listened to a sermon the other day by David Jeremiah where he stressed that we probably need to stop using the word story in this day and age because people that are not churched people hear the word story and think of fable and children's story. So we were talking to youth group Wednesday, trying to train ourselves to use the word account and testimony, because otherwise we portray it's a pretend story, and this is not. So we're going to read through chapter 18. We're going to read all 40 verses because it's pertinent to what we're going to look at, starting at chapter 18, verse 1 of 1 Kings. After many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, "Go show yourself to Ahab, and I'll send rain upon the earth." So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, and when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by fifties in the cave, and fed them with bread and water. And Ahab said to Obadiah, "Go through the land to all the springs of water and to all the valleys. Perhaps we may find grass and save the horses and mules alive and not lose some of the animals." So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Ahab went in one direction by himself, and Obadiah went in another direction by himself. And as Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him. And Obadiah recognized him and fell on his face and said, "It is you, my lord Elijah." And he answered to him, "It is I. Go tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here." And he said, "How have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my lord has not sent to seek you. And when they would say he is not here, he would take an oath of the kingdom or nation that they had not found you. And now you say, 'Go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here.' And as soon as I have gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you, I know not where. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find you, he will kill me. Although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth, has it not been told, my Lord, that I did what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by fifties in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, 'Go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here, and he will kill me.' And Elijah said, 'As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today.' So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When Ahab saw Elijah, he said to him, 'Is it you, you troubler of Israel?' And he answered, 'I have not troubled Israel, but you have in your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now therefore send and gather all Israel to meet me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table.' And so Ahab sent to all the people of Israel, gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel, and Elijah came near to all the people and said, 'How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him.' And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, 'I only am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire on it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered, it is well spoken. Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose for yourself one bull and prepare it first, for you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire on it. And they took the bull that was given them, and they prepared it and called upon the name of Baal, morning until noon, saying, O Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped around the altar that they made, and at noon Elijah mocked them. I'm going to actually stop there. We're going to pick up on that in just a second. So as we look at this account, just a little bit of a recap. Now, the youth group has heard this recap now 6 times in the last 6 weeks. But just to recap, just to remember where we are, if you took time to look at verse or chapter 17, you'll remember that Elijah pops onto the scene in God's word, standing in front of Ahab, telling him it's not going to rain until he says so. And then God tells Elijah to go hide at the brook Cherith. And remember, God told him he was going to feed him by ravens and give him water by the brook. And so Elijah went, didn't question God, lived there for quite some time until there's a drought, the creek started to dry up. Then God told him to go to Zarephath, and there he would find a widow that would feed him. He finds a widow preparing her and her son's last meal and asks for some water and some bread, and she tells him how they only have a little oil and little flour. And Elijah told him, just make something, and it will replenish itself, and it did. Eventually, the widow's son dies, and Elijah takes him up to his prayer chamber and asks God in a mighty way to resuscitate the boy. And, you know, just remember, there had been no resurrection recorded in the Bible until that boy had life breathed into him. So Elijah was asking for something that had never been seen before. It wasn't like he had seen or heard of people being raised from the dead. He asked out of faith, believing. So we come up to this time. Remember, and I keep reminding the teens as we go through this, there is a drought happening. There is a drought that is 3.5 years long. People are dying. The smell of death is everywhere. Animals are dying. Ahab is looking everywhere for this jerk that put this curse on this area, because in Ahab's mind, he angered Baal to withhold prosperity. And so he's a marked man. He's hiding. And he knows, even when he went from the brook to Zarephath, it was like 100-some miles, he's walking out in the open, and as Obadiah we just read, they're looking for him everywhere. So that's all going on while we come to this point of the story, and I'm sure it is fair for us to say there is no way that Elijah could imagine all that had taken place up to this time, but now God has told him in verse 1, go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth. So again, 3 years have passed, 3 years plus, and originally God told him to hide himself, and now God's telling Elijah, show yourself. So even in the Bible, when it says that Elijah told Ahab, it won't rain until I say so, it's when God says so. Because all through this 3.5 years, Elijah is faithfully praying for no rain until God answers, it's time to rain. So God originally told Elijah there's going to be a drought, and now he's telling Elijah that it's time for me to send rain. And the study that we're working in out of the youth group, and actually we did it with the adults Wednesday nights a couple of years ago, there was a book that Chuck Swindoll had written. He says, here is the most wanted man, Elijah, sending Obadiah to tell the king that he is ready to talk to the king. Okay? Don't miss that. Go tell the king I'm ready to talk to him. That's like me saying, hey, can you go tell President Biden I'll see him now? That's what's happening here. Ahab has no power. The only power he has is what God has given him, and now Elijah is exerting the power that God has given him to carry on what is about to happen. We look at verses 7 through 9, just a short account, again, of what he's telling Obadiah. It's told us that Obadiah was a man of God serving under King Ahab. Now, think about that. Jezebel has killed numerous prophets of God. And yet, somehow, in God's grace and his mercy, God has seen fit to keep a man of God over the household under Ahab. And we think in the society that we live in, that we're in the minority, we have no idea the minority that Obadiah was living under. And yet he was obedient man of God. And how is it possible? It's only by God's grace that this man was spared. Spurgeon had a comment about this. He says, "Account for it how you may, it is a singular circumstance that in the center of rebellion against God, there was one whose devotion to God was intense and distinguished. As it is horrible to find a Judas among the apostles, so it is grand to discover an Obadiah among Ahab's courtiers. What grace must have been at work to maintain such a fire in the midst of the sea, such godliness in the midst of the vilest iniquity." That may very well be where we are heading in the lives that we live in, that we're going to be called to be an Obadiah in the sea of America. I hate to say that, but that's where we are heading. And we think of the challenges that we're facing. Obadiah, and I love how Spurgeon said it, in a sea of iniquity, Obadiah was counted faithful. Instead of worrying about what everybody else is doing, I was just challenged again this morning as I read this account of Obadiah again. What am I willing to do because God has called me to do it? Not worrying about what anybody else around me is doing. What have I been called to do? Be faithful. In verse 16, says, "So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah." Here we have what's going on again. As Obadiah is going to get Ahab, this is still in the midst of drought, still in the midst of death. He goes to tell Ahab, and Ahab goes to see Elijah. In the midst of everything going on, I was reminded how, if you watch any news, I don't care whose it is, in the beginning, there's got to be the bum, 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 daily COVID report. How many died? How many are sick? Hospitals, all this kind of stuff. Well, if this time took place right now, every morning would be the drought account. How many people have died? It was the talk every day in the midst of what's going on. Again, we need to get out of story mode and think about the life that's happening for daily for people and for King Ahab. By the way, did you notice what Ahab's biggest concern was in that account of Obadiah? "He and Obadiah are searching the land for pastures so that none of his animals die." No mention of people. He's worried about his own stuff, holding on so tightly to it. You see, the focus of Ahab is so entirely off of God. So we get down to verse 17, and we see Ahab's reaction to Elijah. "When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, 'Is it you, you troubler of Israel?'" Again, we see Elijah's footing the blame for this, and Ahab is more than willing to blame him. "This is all your fault, Elijah." How many times do we find ourselves not living where we should with the Lord, and things are going wrong, and we blame everybody else but ourselves? Everybody else. We are if we stood in front of a mirror, we'd blame somebody else because we're not thinking clearly. We're thinking, "I'm doing everything right. I don't get this. This clown came in here and caused this drought. This is you, you troubler," he says to Elijah. And the idea there, troubler, the idea of stirring up, to cause strife, to make taboo. And many commentators suggest that in Ahab's mind, he's not thinking one true God. He's thinking his puppet God Baal. And he is thinking, you're the one that got Baal mad at us. You're the one that got Asherah angry at us that there's no prosperity. You fool, look what you did. That's what he is saying to Elijah. The idea can also be, instead of troubler, you snake in the grass. Elijah, in Ahab's mind, has really ticked off his God, his false God. Well, we see Elijah through the training that he has had throughout the brook, Cherith, and Zarephath. He quickly, in verse 18, answers, I have not troubled Israel, you have. He points his finger at the king. This is on you and your fathers who have turned away from God. You've abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. This is your fault. It's on your head, Ahab. And what's happening here is Elijah is setting up the battle royale, the true God versus Israel's false gods. And Elijah, I want to be careful. I don't want to impose this all on Elijah's cunningness. This is God's plan that he laid out for Elijah to set up this battle on Mount Carmel. So as we get ready for this, we see preparations for the proof of Yahweh. We see Elijah put together an audience. Verse 19, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. And then he goes on and says, so Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets Mount Carmel, and Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him, but if it's Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. There's debate on why they didn't answer. Some think they didn't answer because there was nothing good they could say to defend themselves. Some believe they didn't answer because they're so apathetic, it wasn't really stirring them to any emotions. But Elijah is careful to draw these 850 prophets, and you see he tells Ahab to get them. He's not getting them. Ahab gathers them, and that little phrase at the end of verse 19, prophets that ate at Jezebel's table, these prophets had a prominent role. They fellowshiped daily with the queen. These are prominent people. These are not closet prophets that nobody knows. These are people that sit at the table. They have the ear of the king and queen. And Elijah wanted to make sure that not just those prophets were there, but the people of Israel to witness what's going to happen. And Elijah addresses their lukewarmness. Just like in Revelation, I think it's the church of Laodicea, where God said, I wish I could spit you out of my mouth because of your wishy-washiness, your lukewarmness. Here are these people, Elijah accuses them. You can't decide. You're like a married woman that has a lover on the side, and you don't want to give up your husband, but you don't want to give up your lover. You want the best of both worlds. You need to decide who you're going to serve. And Elijah, through God's plan, is going to set this up. So what's God's plan? Look at verse 22 through 24. Elijah said to the people, I am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves, cut it in pieces, and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I'll prepare the other bull, and lay it on wood, and put no fire. And you call upon the name of your God, and I'll call upon the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. Elijah keeps this plan very simple. Remember, one of the attributes of Baal is God of fire. So Elijah's giving every opportunity, every benefit to Baal succeeding, at least in their eyes. Go get two bulls. And we'll see, he lets them choose the first bull. So they can't say, oh, well, yeah, of course, I kind of jokingly said to youth group, you chose the drier bull. Elijah, we picked a wet bull. We'll see, that's not going to fly. But he lets them pick the bulls. He lets them go first. He lets all 850 of them do their little dance, whatever they need to do, setting up everything so they have no accusation. Plus, who's getting all this stuff together? It's not pals of Elijah, it's the people. They're getting all these things together, and Elijah's setting up so there'll be no excuses. And we see there at the end of verse 24, the people, that's a great idea. This is an awesome idea. The people were catching on to like, wow, this is really going to be a test. And so you kind of sense the murmuring of the crowd, a little bit of excitement to see what's going to happen. In verse 25, then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose yourselves one bull and prepare it first, for you're many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it. So we come to round one, verse 26. Round one is the false gods. So they, the prophets, took the bull that was given them. They prepared it and called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, oh, Baal, answer us. There's no voice. No one answered. And they limped around the altar that they had made. We see these false prophets carry out Elijah's plan exactly. And they start yelling out, oh, Baal, answer us. That's all they hear. Baal, answer us. There's an altar sitting there. Nothing's happening. They get desperate. They start to dance around. Look at verse 27. At noon, Elijah starts mocking them. No, cry. You got to cry louder. Maybe you got to cry a little bit louder. Either he's musing, or he's relieving himself, or maybe he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened. Now we see Elijah taking the opportunity to mock these false gods. He mocks them in front of all of the prophets and the people. And his scoffing is really strong. And let's be, what God's word says here is what Elijah said. We're not mincing words. Yep. You know what? Maybe he's musing. Maybe he's like that Roman statue of the thinker. Maybe he's just really deep in thought. Maybe you're not yelling loud enough. You know what? It says it here in the Bible. Maybe he's in the bathroom. It's what Elijah says. Think of what that would have sounded like back then to suggest the word bathroom with a god. I mean, Elijah is making it very clear. You got to try harder. You know, maybe he has a sign on the door that says, gone fishing. Just yell louder. You're just not putting your all into it. And then look what happens in 28 and 29. They cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation, but there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. This is going on for hours, and it incites the silence, incites these prophets to get more violent in their cries. And really, the scene starts to turn morbid. They're cutting each other. They're self-inflicted wounds, thinking that shedding some of their blood may get their God's attention. And desperation keeps growing. And remember, these priests who ate at the queen's table are now slicing each other up, trying to get attention to false gods. And I missed writing down what commentator it was. It might have been Chuck Swindoll suggested that this scene in front of this altar is in some ways a picture of what hell is going to be like as people cry and yell and scream for relief and nothing comes. The scene that would have been here would be nothing short of gross and intense morbidity, because you're seeing human beings at the depth of their sinfulness destroying themselves for a fake god. That is the point where we are there at the end of verse 29. Well, now we look at verses 30 through 35, and we see round two is Jehovah. And verse 30, Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me," and all the people came near. And he prepared the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, "Israel shall be your name." And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench about the altar as great as would contain 2 seahs of seed. And he put the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood and said, "Fill 4 jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood." And he said, "Do it a second time." And he did it a second time. And then he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. What's the first thing Elijah does? He goes to rebuild the altar of Jehovah that once was on Mount Carmel. He builds an altar that used to be there all the time. And he didn't touch the altar at all that was Baal's. He built one again for the true God. And Elijah was careful to prove without a doubt that there was a miracle about to happen. He takes water and just constantly dumps it on this altar that he is going to ask God to ignite. An impossibility by human standpoints. You know how hard it is to start wet wood and build a fire, let alone wet meat with water laying all around it. And yet Elijah sets this up so that there will be no mistake what is about to happen. Some question, well, how did he get water if there was a drought? Well, if you look on the map, Mount Carmel is not very far from the Mediterranean Sea, and the Mediterranean Sea did not dry up. So there was water available from the sea. But here we have this altar all set up, and verse 36, it says, "At the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, 'O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back.'" Such a simple prayer from Elijah. We see his faith shining through in this simple prayer to our God. And it's nothing like the ravenous prophets of Baal. There is this peaceful quiet in his prayer. Remember, it says there that he drew the people near. He wanted people to be right there to see what's about to happen. Quiet and measured was the point of his prayer. And he was very careful not to box God in by his request. And that is one thing that I think I learned from reading about Elijah, is that we have to be so careful sometimes that we don't concoct this big prayer request of how we think something should be fixed by God, because we've thought it all out and this would be the best way to do it. Elijah prays for fire. He knows that Baal is the god of fire. Other than that, it could be lightning, could be spontaneous, it could be anything. Elijah just prays that this altar would be ignited. And in verse 13, "The fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offerings and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, 'The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God.'" God's response to Elijah's prayer was immediate. It happened immediately after Elijah prayed and fire comes down. It's important to note that God did it by showing the fire was from above. It was not from human doing. It was not from some type of accelerant poured on this altar. It was simply God igniting this altar with the fire from heaven. Physically, it brought fire down from heaven. Spiritually, it changed the people's hearts. And that should be the end of the account. But there's one more part of this that we need to look at. Is Elijah decides through God's leading to take care of some cancer. He performs cancer surgery in verse 40. And Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape." And they seized them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. Elijah acts really swiftly. This altar is lit. The people see the one true God at work in lighting this altar and burning everything up. And Elijah turns and has them seize the prophets and take them down to the brook. And all 850 are killed. Some think, wow, that's harsh. You know what? It's just like when Carolyn discovered she had breast cancer, there was immediate and swift action to take care of it while it's right there. And that is what Elijah did. These prophets were wiped out. Obviously, to some degree, an account of what Jezebel did to the prophets of the Lord that she killed. But these people saw these 850 slaughtered. The sad part is the people's hearts did not stay true to God very long. It's easy to say Israel is a very forgetful people, but are we not that same forgetful many times? We forget so quickly how God has worked in our lives. Well, here the wicked false prophets of Baal are dead, partially because they played an important part in leading these people astray, and they are no more. We could continue on to read the story. Maybe you want to do that when you get home. I just said story again. The account that Elijah immediately, we won't get into it all today, but immediately after killing of the prophets, what does he do? He starts praying for the rain to come. It seems throughout this whole account of Elijah's life, prayer, God answers. Prayer, God answers. And you know, Elijah gets on his knees, starts praying, tells one of his servants to look for any sense of rain, and seven times he keeps telling him to go back. "I don't see anything. Just go back. Master, I still don't see. Can you just go back?" And eventually a little hand-shaped cloud appears, and he tells Ahab, you better get back to Jezreel before your chariots get stuck in the mud, because it's going to rain real soon. And Ahab takes off for Jezreel. And what happens? God gives him God's speed, and Elijah beats him to Jezreel, running on foot to welcome him to Jezreel in the rain. What are some lessons to learn from Elijah? What is important about these accounts that we can apply to our lives? Well, one is when we are sure we are in the will of God, we are invincible with God's strength. When we are in the will of God, we are invincible. Consequences mean nothing. To Obadiah, yes, you could say he wavered a little bit when Elijah said, "Go tell Ahab I need to meet with him." But up to that moment, whatever Obadiah was told to do, he did it if it was obedient to God, a.k.a. Daniel, a.k.a. Joseph. And he became a man of God over the household of Ahab. And you think about this account that we were looking at, the odds for Elijah seemed insurmountable. 850-1 were the odds. But actually, the odds were 850-1 plus one, plus the one. And that trumps any number of false prophets that you could possibly put together. So the odds were always in Elijah's favor. And Elijah gained this knowledge through his life experiences. I mean, really, any of us that would be told, "Go live by the creek down there behind Barnt Road, and crows are going to feed you." Crows. Birds that eat off of dead carcasses. Birds that aren't hunting birds. These are going to feed you. And a brook is going to give you nourishment during a drought. We would be, what? How's that going to work? Elijah knew he was in God's will, and he did what was asked. He shows up, meets a widow, and she's got nothing left except enough morsels to put together bread for her and her son to eat, their last meal before they die. And God says, this widow's going to feed you. We don't see any squabbling. We don't see any doubt. Elijah was where God told him to be, and he acted accordingly. Even when the son died, he just takes the son. He doesn't, the lady's going berserk. You brought this on me. This is your fault. Sound familiar? This is your fault, Elijah. We started doing better, and now my son died. We would have been better off just dying with our last meal. Elijah didn't dispute her, didn't do anything. Give me your son. And he goes upstairs and lays on him three times and prays, God, breathe life into this boy. That was his prayer chamber. He had been trained well by God to believe the impossibles could happen. The other lesson to learn is our most effective tool is the prayer of faith. And I'm reminded again in working on these lessons with the youth group, is prayer my go-to tool? Is it the first tool that I grab? Or is it the default tool when I can't fix it? Is it my go-to tool or my, whatever you'd want to call it, consolation prize tool that everything I did doesn't work, I guess I ought to pray. Anybody ever been there? That you pray after you try to figure things out? Anybody? Just Dan's the only one. And my wife. It is habit that we don't stop immediately and pray. It should not be our last-ditch tool. In fact, we've all heard of Hudson Taylor. Howard Taylor, his son, said of his father, the sun never rose on China for 40 years, but that God did not find my father in prayer. 40 years. Prayer first to Hudson Taylor for China. Not prayer third. Not, you know, oh, this didn't go right. God, what are you doing here? What a testimony to have your son say that about you. One other lesson, never underestimate the prayerful power of our God in the impossible in one totally dedicated life. Turn to James 5. We're done in 1 Kings. We tend to forget that Elijah is mentioned in the New Testament. Never underestimate the prayerful power of our God of the impossible in one totally dedicated life. Look at James 5, 13 through 18. Is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing praise. Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith shall save the one who is sick, and the Lord will raise him up. And if he has committed sins, he will be forgiven. Therefore, confess your sins to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous person has great power as it is working. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed fervently that it might not rain. And for 3 years and 6 months, it did not rain on the earth. And then he prayed again, and heaven gave rain, and the earth bore its fruit. Elijah was no different than us. That's what James is saying. He didn't have supernatural powers. He didn't have some kind of extraordinary gift. God is very clear in pointing out to us that Elijah was just like Mike, just like Adam, just like Dan, just like Colleen, just like Kim. He's just a human being that set in his mind that he was going to obey God no matter what. That he believed that his God was the God of the impossible. And I thought about as Colleen sent that email out today about our praise, about Carolyn being seemingly healed of cancer with the surgery that they did, to the point where they didn't need to do chemo. And then I read the testimony of Shirley. And I will choose to believe, with some knowledge of how Shirley prayed, that it's very possible that one of Shirley's last prayers was for Carolyn, because she always mentioned to us how she prayed for our children regularly. And I think about the fact that Shirley, in her last days, couldn't speak, couldn't talk, was probably not even awake. And now she knows, as she's in heaven, that her prayers were answered. Think about the importance of prayer and the importance of believing that our God can do the impossible. I said to Ryan, we were having breakfast on Friday morning, and I hope we can all say this, but I am thankful that I can say this. I really think I need to write a little book for our family when we're gone to remember the impossibilities that God has done in our life. Real impossibilities. Some of you have witnessed those things happen in our family in ways that you don't see very often. What looks like bad is turned around for good. You remember Mark and Jess. Mark, for years, had to work on Sundays at Raymore and Flanagan and prayed routinely, God, please figure out a way that I don't have to work on Sundays anymore. And God creates a job over near the Jersey border for a position that was going to be created so Mark could move there and have a job that he wouldn't have to work Sundays. And we prayed that, God, if this is your answer, give them the peace to move. We knew they were struggling to find a church, to build friendships, make relationships. Seemed like that would be challenging. But we prayed, and I remember praying so fervently, God, I just pray that you would make whatever needs to happen to answer Mark's prayer for working, not having to work on Sundays. And so Mark says yes to taking the job, and in 24 hours he gets a call from his boss where he worked that out of the blue, a new job was created right here in Quakertown that he wouldn't have to move and still not have to work on Sundays. All Mark had to do was say, yes, I'm willing to move, God. And God said, that's good, because I wasn't going to move you anyway. He believed in the God of impossibilities. I could go on and on and bore you with Kirby miracle stories. But they're true. So the challenge is, what is it in your life that you have never prayed an Elijah prayer? God, do whatever you need to do here. What is it? It could be, what keeps you from coming out Wednesday nights? It could be, why can't I have a close friend that I can confide in and have fellowship with that gets me? It could be, Lord, save my child's soul. But many times we shrink down our prayers because we really don't believe it's going to happen. And Elijah was not that way. And the lesson is, if Elijah is a man just like us, that we can be a man like Elijah if we just put all of our faith and trust in God, because he can do anything. Don't hem him in with your solutions. Just bring the request to him. My son is still not saved, Sean. He is not today. I have prayed a lot. Marcy has prayed a lot. But I believe with all my heart that Sean is going to get saved. I just don't know how it's going to happen. And that means there may have to be hardship, there may have to be death, there may have to be loss of job. I don't know what it is. But God has taught me, just trust me and pray with faith, believing. David Jeremiah had a quote about this. In Hebrews, he says in Hebrews 6:18, it tells us, it is impossible for God to lie. Hebrews 11:6 adds that without faith it is impossible for us to please him. It demonstrates how important it is to cast our impossibilities in God's hands. Just as he parted the sea for Israel, reversed the events in Esther, raised Jesus from the dead, and converted Saul of Tarsus, God is capable of reversing our irreversible problems. What is it today that you have not committed to Him? God, I know you can fix this, make this happen, whatever. Let's bow our heads in word of prayer.